So before we end the sitting, I'd like to tell you a little bit about the ceremony, what we're doing here today, and tell you a story that you can take in as part of your meditation. Today is the full moon day of May, and the full moon day of May is the day in which the Theravadin Buddhists celebrate the birth, the enlightenment, and the passing away of the Buddha. And the full moon has a great symbolic value in Buddhism. The full moon represents the mind, the heart mind, which is totally free, liberated, filled with love and compassion. And to celebrate the enlightenment of the Buddha is to celebrate that full moon of awakening, that full heart, full mind of the Buddha. But it's also to celebrate that within us. And it's nice to think about the full moon, because the full moon is always full. It's only from our perspective that it's half moon, quarter moon, new moon. Sometimes the moon is obscured by clouds, but the moon doesn't care. The enlightenment of the Buddha resonates, hopefully, with some deep innate sense each of us have about our own deepest goodness, our own radiant mind and heart, the deepest sense of love that each of us know. Imagine yourself in ancient India, and you've heard reports about the existence of the Buddha, and you decide to go visit this man because in India, for many generations, people have been trying to become Buddhas, become realized, become free. And here was finally a person who had accomplished that. And really good reports about this wonderful man had come your way. And you travel to Varanasi, where you heard that he was staying for the rain season. And you get there and you meet a lovely, very peaceful Buddhist nun who receives you very generously and tells you, in fact, that the Buddha had gone on, traveled up to the foot, a few weeks ago, traveled to the foothills of the Himalayas. So you head up north into the woods and the prairies of northern India, and you spend days walking. And you come to the final foothills, only to be told, oh, the Buddha was here a week ago, but he traveled east. But the person who tells you that is somehow radiantly happy, peaceful, and tells you the story of meeting the Buddha and how important it was. And you're quite inspired, and you head on east. And as you walk further east, you meet more and more people who are eager to tell you the stories of meeting this man. And each of them seems to have a kind of peace or glint or delight in their eyes as they point the way and say, oh yeah, he was here 2 days ago. He was here a day ago. And finally you come to a place and someone says, oh, he's up on that hill in that grove of trees, together with a large company of disciples, of monks and nuns and lay people. And the excitement that you have, perhaps, is quite great after these many days' journey to finally be reaching the end of your goal. So you go down to the river and wash your feet and face, hands, put on new clothes, take off your shoes in order to approach the Buddha barefoot, and you head up into the woods, into the grove on top of the hill. And at first you're a little bit surprised and a little bit apprehensive because you've been told that there are dozens and dozens of people with the Buddha. As you enter the grove of woods, there's not a single sound. How can there be so many people here and I hear nothing? But then you notice that they're all sitting and meditating, quietly, peacefully. You've never seen so many people together in one place with such serenity. And as you get to the top of the hill and the clearing of the grove, there sits the Buddha. And there's something remarkable about this person. On one hand, he seems very normal, ordinary. You're surprised how ordinary he seems. Seems like you've seen many Indians, fellow Indians, who are just like him. But there's something beyond the ordinariness. There's some kind of ease he has about being himself that immediately puts you to ease. There seems to be nothing to fear from this man. And there seems that there's nothing. No, he doesn't elicit any fear in you. He seems to want nothing and seems to look at you as if, how could you want anything? He looks into you, he sees you, clearly sees you, and you've never perhaps been seen so clearly by another person. He can see through you or deep into you. And at the very same time, it's as if he doesn't see you at all. As he sees, goes right by you. Seen and not seen. Not seen because he wants nothing, needs nothing, requires nothing. And he seems to be radiating a kind of love, a kind of compassion and delight. And you never met such love before, because a love seems to be almost synonymous with peace, with being at ease. This is a person who doesn't seem to need to defend himself for anything, doesn't seem to need to prove himself in any way. He just seems to be there, at ease with himself. And all those qualities seem in some way to speak to something deep inside of yourself, some deep knowing of a possibility of a way to live that perhaps you've intuited in the past that is possible. Or perhaps you never really knew it, but now that it's been pointed to you, it feels like you always knew it as a possibility. And then this man begins to speak. And he seems to always speak very simple things. You heard many philosophers in India before him. It seems so complex. And the Buddha speaks and it's so simple. And he says, this world we live in, human life, is imbued with a fair measure of difficulties and suffering. And the suffering that you encounter, the suffering that you experience, arises from your clinging. When your clinging comes to an end, and it's possible to end your clinging, you will also experience this peace that I know. You'll also experience this great love and compassion that I know. And I'll teach you a simple path that you can follow that allow you to let go of your clinging, even the deepest, deepest clingings in your heart. And that path is to have right view or understanding, to understand the nature of suffering. It's to have the right intention to be engaged in the practice not for gain, status, not for comfort, but for release, for freedom. To have right speech, to speak what's true. To have right livelihood, to make a living that doesn't hurt other people in the process. To have right action, right behavior. So that your actions express a sensitivity to life around you. To cultivate effort, to be engaged, not complacent. To practice mindfulness and to practice concentration. These things are what create the conditions for letting go. And the greater the letting go, the greater your peace and the greater your love. Let go, let go. Nothing whatsoever is worth holding on to. Let go of it all. So today when we do the Sabba Sata Sukhi Honto chant, and today when we do it, would you, you know, each time we stop in between and do it for some different people, like mothers and parents and kids and old people and all these, will you say it each time, kind of go through in different categories and say it a little bit louder so everyone can hear, then we'll repeat. Is that okay with you? Great. Those are really nice flowers, Anya. Those are really nice flowers. Do you want to put your nice flowers up on the top here so everyone can see them? Right up here. I'll help you. So, about 90 or 200 generations of people connect us to the Buddha. And the celebration of the Buddha's birth and his enlightenment and passing away is also a time to bring in the next generation of Buddhas. And if we are very careful with how we live our lives, then we'll create the conditions where they can become Buddhas also. And how does a person express their Buddhahood, Blake? How does a person know they're a Buddha?
By what's in their
heart. So can you say it louder?
By what's in their heart.
And what's in... Celebrate the baby Buddha. This is a baby up here. It's supposed to be a little baby. And when a baby gets born, you're supposed to wash the baby like this. And get the baby all clean so that it's... Well, why did we clean the baby? So it's nice and healthy. and also what we do is we remind ourselves of certainly the Buddha, but those qualities that the Buddha really represents, the qualities of love, loving kindness, compassion, freedom, peace. And so we're going to do the first. We're going to start with doing a simple chant, the chant of loving kindness, and Blake will help us through it. And it's four words. And those words are sabbe, sata, sukhi, hontu. Sabba means all. Sata means beings. Sukhi means happy. And hontu means something like may they be. May all beings be happy. Now, as we say this, this is particularly important to, we all say this kind of in our own hearts, kind of seeing if we can evoke whatever kind of feeling of love, compassion, care you have for the world around you, for the next generation, for the generations to come. Because as you do it, we're going to, in this amazing way, it's going to impregnate this water. And when this water is properly impregnated with our intention, we're going to bless some of these babies with this water. And so we'll do it sabbe, sata, sukhi, hontu. Blake and I will start one word at a time, and we'll do it maybe a couple of times, and then once you kind of get the hang of it, we'll do it all together. And then in between each time we say it, we'll mention some category of beings that we would like our happiness and our well-being, our love, to be sent out to. So you first repeat after us the words. Sabbe.
Sabbe.
Sata.
Sata.
Sukhi.
Sukhi.
Hontu.
Hontu.
Sabbe.
Sabbe.
Sata.
Sata.
Sukhi.
Sukhi.
Hontu.
Hontu.
And all together. Sabbe. Sata. Sukhi. Hontu. Sabbe. Sata. Sukhi. Hontu. Sabbe. Sata. Sukhi. Hontu.
May all babies be happy.
Sabbe. Sata. Sukhi. Hontu.
May everyone in this room be happy.
Sabbe. Sata. Sukhi. Hontu.
May all animals be happy.
Sabbe. Sata. Sukhi. Hontu.
May all poor people be happy.
Sabbe. Sata. Sukhi. Hontu.
May all teachers be happy.
Sabbe. Sata. Sukhi. Hontu. One more. Let's do one more. Sick people.
May all sick people be happy.
Sabbe. Sata. Sukhi. Hontu. Water is quite thick, and we would like to pass on our very best wishes and a welcome into the world for those people who are relatively new to it, and for whom we would like to prepare the way so that as they grow up and when they become adults, that they really understand the treasure that's in their own hearts. The treasure that we, with our diligent effort and sometimes with great dedication, great effort, are trying to unveil and discover that's in ourselves. We're not trying to attain something different than who we are, but to discover that which is there. Not even for our own sake, but maybe for the sake of these children and these babies. Anicca vata sankara upadavayo dhammino upakitva niruchanti tesang vupasamo sukho. Anicca vata sankara upadavayo dhammino upakitva niruchanti tesang vupasamo sukho. Anicca vata sankara upadavayo dhammino upakitva niruchanti tesang vupasamo sukho. Anicca vata sankara upadavayo dhammino upakitva niruchanti tesang vupasamo sukho. So Blake, will you come and sprinkle, maybe this one holds more water. So, let's see, try this one. So come up here and get as much water on this as you can, and then get these people really wet. But be careful with the little girls, because they're a little bit afraid. Okay, and then kind of sprinkle in all the, first in one direction. Yeah. So you've all been blessed. And then we're going to do one more simple chant. And while we're doing a simple chant, the kids who would like to do it, or their parents, can come up here and wash the baby Buddha. And when we wash the baby Buddha, when we bow to a Buddha image, we're really bowing to ourselves. And when we wash a baby Buddha, we're really washing ourselves. So the simple chant is Namo, which means something like homage. Buddha, which is Buddha. Actually, Buddhaya, simply means homage to the Buddha. Namo Buddhaya. And then Dharma, Dhamma. Let's do Dharma, since that's English now. And then Sangha. So it's Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dharmaya, and Namo Sanghaya. And we'll just do that for a while. And as we pay homage to these three treasures, then Blake will start. And then if the other kids would like to come up here and wash this baby Buddha. So, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dharmaya, Namo Sanghaya, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Sanghaya, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dharmaya, Namo Sanghaya, Namo Buddhaya. Okay. Namo Namo Buddhaya, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dharmaya, Namo Sanghaya, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dharmaya, Namo Sanghaya, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dhammaya, Namo Sanghaya, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dharmaya, Namo Sanghaya, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Sanghaya, Namo Sanghaya, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dharmaya, Namo Sanghaya, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dhammaya, Namo Sanghaya, Namo Buddhaya, Namo Dhammaya, Namo Sanghaya. So there's one more chant, recitation we can do before the children. If they want to go, they can go. We'll continue with our merry ways. And that is, we want to do it in their presence, because I think it's very important to show this in their presence. And that is, on a gathering like this, on the full moon of May, or Buddhist celebration like this, one of the established conventions is for everyone to recite the five lay precepts. And I will recite them in English. I'll do half of the line each time, and then you can repeat. And then we'll go through all five. And these are the five guidelines. These are the five guidelines that protect us. And many people wish they had these protections when they were younger. And they are very significant forms of protection. And when I teach the children about the precepts, I don't call them precepts, I call them the five protections. So repeat after me. For the sake of our lives together,
I vow not to kill.
For the sake of our lives together,
I vow not to take what is not given.
For the sake of our lives together,
I vow not to lie.
For the sake of our lives together, I vow not to engage in sexual misconduct. For the sake of our lives together, I vow not to intoxicate body or mind. Do you want to hit the bell? No? Anya, do you want to hit the bell? How about you, Blake? You want to hit it? One more time. Thank you, all kids, for coming. It's very nice to have you here. So Blake, if you want, you're welcome to stay if you want, but it might not interest you so much. Yeah. Bye-bye. Bye, Andrew. So in a few minutes, you're going to, if you want, have a chance to come up here informally and wash the baby Buddha. The original idea of the child within. And the wonderful, I think, balance. Often in Buddhist practice, opposite qualities, so seemingly opposite qualities, are both needed in balance together. Often we tend to think sometimes only in one, only one way is the right way. So for example, relaxation or concentration, calm, is a very important part of Buddhist practice. But it has to exist together with actually a very strong sense of effort and energy. And we don't often think of the two going together. There's many pairs like that. And the two statues in front of me, one is of the Buddha as a baby, and the other is the Buddha as an adult. I think he was about 36 years old when he was enlightened, attained his liberation. And the process of liberation that, for the Buddha, as I like to talk about, is require these two elements. It required a childlike openness to life, to himself. Childlike kind of innocence, as we talked about. Child openness, kind of willingness to take it all in, not being defensive, not hiding, not holding back. But at the same time, an adult-like stability, an adult-like strength. And the combination of those two, if there's only one, if an adult only has one or the other, it's the person's imbalance. But by having both, the possibility of liberation opens for a person. Because you need to have the openness, the childlike openness to everything, to allow life to move through you freely, completely. But if it moves through you freely and completely, all kinds of things that you don't even like will come through, will come your way. And so you have to be able to sit there with great stability and know how, with great strength, how not to react or get afraid or get angry, but let it all just flow through you. And this is what's needed. And as it all flows through, without any ripple of reaction in the mind, with the mind not going for or against anything, with the mind not closing up or opening, closing up or grasping to anything, then it's a possibility of this ultimate letting go, which the Buddha represents. The story of the Buddha's birth is a miracle story. You've probably heard of founders of religions whose births have miracle stories connected to them. It's a miracle. And this particular one was he was born miraculously out of the side of his mother. And for whatever reasons that they chose. And then, being somewhat of a ahead of his time, he took seven steps. The first thing he did. And but because it was a Buddha, miraculously, lotus blossoms appeared under each step, so he wouldn't have to touch, the dust of the ground. This photograph here shows him being born. And his mother was standing, holding a tree. So that's how he was born, while his mother was standing. He's supposed to jump out of his mother's side, the first Caesarean. And then he took seven steps. And then he pointed one finger up into the sky and one finger down to the earth. And he said, "Heaven above, earth below, I alone am the world-honored one." So here in modern California, we think he was the first egotist saying something like that. But really, it's kind of a mythic story. That we have to, in these stories, the way these myths work, is we have to understand how we can say this for ourselves and how we can allow everyone, each person, to say it for themselves. Heaven above, earth below, I alone am the world-honored one. I am the most special one. I'm the greatest. There's something really honorable and wonderful and fantastic about each person. Kind of the way maybe a parent sees their baby. You know, I mean, when I saw my baby, he could do no wrong. I'm nostalgic But to have that way of seeing oneself. And of course, you know, we can make mistakes and there's peculiarities in who we are. But even with those things, can we find a way, can we find a really true and honest way to say, heaven above, earth below, I alone am the world-honored one. Because in your direct experience, it can't be anybody else. And the photograph over here was taken when the Buddha was passed away. And he died when he was in his about 80, 81 years old. And what's quite remarkable about the Buddha's dying was how peaceful it was, equanimous. He knew he was dying. He lay down between two trees. And he seemed completely at peace with the idea. He wasn't trying to avoid it. And he was teaching people right up near the end. And he was concerned about the people around him, so they would be okay, you know, after he died. And so he gave some instructions. And then he lay down. And with great acceptance, or great, maybe the kind of acceptance, it's not even acceptance, just great acceptance of both life and death, he quite willingly prepared for his death. And he went through his meditative states, the deep meditation that he was capable of attaining. And he went through his meditative states, and when he reached a state of great equanimity, the fantastic level of equanimity, that was it. Then he went. And there's four questions you're not allowed to ask a Buddhist. You're not allowed to ask, what happens to a Buddha? Does a Buddha exist after he dies or she dies? Does a Buddha not exist after he or she dies? Does a Buddha neither exist nor not exist? Or does a Buddha both exist and not exist? You're not allowed to ask those questions. So he attained this great state of equanimity, and then he went. In between his birth and his death was his awakening, his enlightenment. And it's very nice to think of the Buddha's liberation, his enlightenment, occurring sandwiched between birth and death. This is really the place of liberation, is right in the middle of birth and death, the world of birth and death. The world of birth and death that happens all around us all the time, and which happens moment to moment in our experience. That Buddhist practice is to really help us to, as honestly and fully and completely and thoroughly possible, come to terms with birth and with death. So this is one person who did this. There's only 90 or so people between us and the Buddha. It's not very many people. There's probably 90 people in this room. So the generation of people who taught me, they got it from someone else, a living lineage of someone who taught them and someone who taught them. And as we meet here in this room with this candle and this Buddha and the water and the flowers, that we're really continuing a living thread of possibility, of inspiration, of reflection, of reflecting back into our own hearts that it's possible not to base our life on greed, hate, and delusion, on acquisition and possessions and money and houses and jobs, but rather to base our lives on something much more enduring and valuable. The love, the compassion, and the peace which resides in the full moon of each of your hearts. May each of you realize the Buddha within. May each of you, as you watch the Buddha, realize yourself. So what I'd like to do now is to invite you all to come up, as you wish, and wash the baby Buddha. There's a lot of people, so don't linger too long. And also, if we have some time, 15 minutes left, it's also a nice time to maybe spend a little bit of time talking to some of the people around you. We often just come and are quiet and leave. And a very important part of Buddhist life is this life of our connection to other practitioners, and to at least know there are other people in the world who share something in common with you. So before we actually break now, what I'd like to ask you to do is to turn to one or two people near you, the people near you perhaps you know the least, and just say hello and introduce yourself and say something that occurs to you. and then it can be very simple. You can bow when you're ready and say goodbye, and then if you want, you can come up here and wash the Buddha. Thank you.